Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you know?
Yeah, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's a delicious, wonderful Dar Wayam singing with Keith Seeger and David Burns here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show on PRN for another great hour here in Solartopia. We're going to be joined, or we hopefully are joined, by Kevin Camps. Kevin, are you there with us?
Hello, Harvey.
Kevin, you are so reliable. It's always great to know. And then at 5:30, hopefully, we'll be joined by Rex Weiler from the Great Northwest. Kevin, you'll be welcome to stay with us. I want to talk to Rex about a fantastic film I saw on the birth of Greenpeace called How to Change the World. And of course, Rex has been on with us before. He's a mainstay of so many great things with Greenpeace and fighting nuclear power and all that great stuff. Kevin, you are the man from Beyond Nuclear. You are waist deep in Big Muddy here about fighting nuclear power, and it's just an honor to have you on again to
Thank
our
you.
Show to update us on the latest developments in the insane, sick, and hopefully soon-to-be-gone world of atomic energy. So start at the top here. You're dealing with our radioactive waste confidence appeals. Tell us about that, what's going on, especially how it might affect new licenses. It's hard to conceive that anybody would want to build a new nuclear plant in this world, but we're talking about Fermi 3 and some others. So tell us about what's going on with that.
Yeah, just in the last week or so, a coalition of 10 environmental groups and 4 states and the Prairie Island Indian community of Minnesota filed another round in the legal battle that's referred to as New York versus NRC. So this is round 2, and another way of calling it is nuclear waste confidence, because that is the policy of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission dating back to 1984, and that's very appropriate because it's so very Orwellian, where NRC has said that they are confident that radioactive waste, high-level nuclear waste generated by atomic reactors, can be stored safely at the nuclear power plant sites and ultimately will be disposed of somehow, some way, someday, somewhere, safely.
Well, except, isn't that special? I mean, I always
in the latest update to their nuclear waste confidence policy, NRC has done away with that someday, somewhere, it's going to get buried safely thing, which itself, by getting away with doing away with that, they have violated the Atomic Energy Act, because they're supposed to assure safety for radioactive waste on-site, away from reactor. They're not even trying to anymore. They're not pretending to like they did for so long. So this coalition has filed major legal papers at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, and the schedule is set. The NRC now responds in September. Our side responds in November, I think it is. And then sometime next year, there are going to be oral arguments in D.C. What this means is, if the court rules that the NRC has violated the Atomic Energy Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, that Fermi 3 new reactor proposal that you mentioned could see its license that the NRC has already granted be overturned, at least for a time, until NRC can get its paperwork straight. And old reactor license extensions like Davis-Bessey in Ohio, Fermi 2 in Michigan, and there are actually dozens of proceedings across the country that would be impacted. You could see those license extensions blocked, at least until NRC can be forced to, you know, do its legal obligations.
Well, when has the NRC ever done its legal obligations? The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, no real chance, nobody really cares, no residual credibility. I mean, come on. And nuclear waste and confidence are oxymorons when you put them together. So What we have now in the United States is what, there's 70 plus reactor sites, right? And nuclear waste is sitting at all of them.
Now, you've got permanently closed down ones where everything's been dismantled, including the storage pool for high level radioactive waste. And all you've got left at places like Maine Yankee, Connecticut Yankee, Big Rock Point in Michigan is an open field with silos of high level radioactive waste behind a fence. And NRC is also saying that that's all safe. The problem is, if anything goes wrong at those sites, there's nowhere for this high-level waste to go. It's so deadly radioactive that you need radiation shielding between it and humans at all times. So if you have a breach of one of these silos, there's no pool to retreat back into anymore. So they've really painted all of us into a corner on this this deadly threat that will be deadly forever.
What a nightmare. We're talking with Kevin Camps here from Beyond Nuclear. I know we just shut two reactors at San Onofre in California, a great victory. And now we're confronting the fact that the utility company wants to put the stuff there basically in tin cans. The Germans are using dry cask storage with structures that are about 20 inches thick, I think. And the people in San Onofre want, what, 3 inches, something like that?
Yeah, the U.S. cast designs involve very little metal and oftentimes compensate with thicker concrete as the radiation shielding, none of which, but I should hasten to add, the German casks are vulnerable to this as well. None of these dry casks are defendable against anti-tank weaponry. So there was actually a German cask, one of these thick ones you're describing, which may have advantages over the U.S. models for things like corrosion because they're much thicker. But for things like an attack by an anti-tank missile, there was a test done at Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland in 1998. It used a tow anti-tank missile against a German castor cask, and no surprise, the tow missile blew a hole through this 15-inch thick German cask, about as big around as a grapefruit. And the other line of defense, say a concrete flak jacket, was just turned to dust and it blew away. So, you know, they don't worry about terrorist attacks in the design of these dry casks. And that's why 200 groups across the country representing every state in the union have called for hardened on-site storage, which would include defenses against terrorist attacks.
Man, it's amazing we have to still talk about this stuff. You know, I mean, we have solar energy coming on. The windmills work. It's very, very clear where the world is going to go with this. And yet today I read on the Internet, Kevin Camps, that South Africa is lining up to buy, what, 8 commercial atomic reactors? And they might buy them from Russia? I mean, Nelson Mandela must be flipping in his grave.
Well, you know, South Africa, under the apartheid regime, was actually a nuclear weapons power. It was secretive, and they were working in cooperation with Israel. There's even evidence that the two countries worked together to carry out a nuclear detonation in the Indian Ocean as a test. So there's a long history of nuclear involvement, both weapons and power, in South Africa.
God.
And there's a lot of uranium mining in southern Africa, so there is kind of a rabid nuclear industry in South Africa, and it's not unlike Canada. Canada's never dabbled in the weaponry directly, but they certainly have sold reactors to military dictatorships around the world back in the 70s, which were very interested in acquiring nuclear weapons, and Canada was a ready partner for that. So India, for example, used a Canadian research reactor and a U.S. reprocessing technology to blow up its first nuclear weapon in 1974. So South Africa is in that same club, historically speaking.
On the other hand, I just posted an article at nukefree.org that Taiwan is closing giving up on a reactor project on which they already spent $9 billion. And the article, which I posted at nukefree.org, or linked it, talks about how the site, this $9 billion site that would have been nuclear, but thankfully is not, is being overrun by wild dogs and deer. Did you see that one?
That's compliments of the anti-nuclear movement of Taiwan, which will turn out tens or even hundreds of thousands of people at protest rallies. So they've made all the difference on that.
Yeah, well, we should bring them over here, for God's sakes. Now, you, yeah. Kevin, being a Michigan boy, have been working very hard on the Palisades reactor and also on Fermi 3. So tell us what's going on in and Fermi 2, which is more of a threat as far as I'm concerned. Fermi 2 is, operating, or sort of operating. Fermi 3 is still just basically, you know, a wet dream for all the big corporations. I will mention, by the way, the Fermi site is in Monroe, Michigan. And I turned on, I was just channel flipping. No, I was on the internet, and I noticed that Stephen Colbert, did you catch this? Stephen Colbert.
Yeah.
And he hosted a talk show on the local cable channel in Monroe, Michigan. And he had Eminem or Marshall Mathers come on and talk to him. Did you see that? That was really,
yeah,
really
yeah.
amazing.
And no mention of Fermi, unfortunately.
No, I know. I bet you, Kevin, being the stalwart diehard that you are, I bet you sat through the whole interview waiting to see if Stephen Colbert was going to mention Fermi. Am I right?
Exactly. That's true. I mean, there was so much discussion of music in the region there, and they forgot Gil Scott-Heron's song about Fermi. We almost lost Detroit.
Oh. It's too bad we couldn't call into that thing, you know?
Yeah.
Colbert is quite the character. But, of course, Fermi, Monroe, Michigan, is the only city in the world that has a memorial statue to George Armstrong Custer. I like that a lot. And, of course, the great Michael Keegan was there fighting the nuke day in and day out. So, at any rate, Kevin, what's happening with Palisades and with Fermi? Update us on these two horrific reactors, and then we're going to talk about Davis Bessie in Ohio.
Sure. So at Palisades, we just won a very hard-won hearing that was granted by an Atomic Safety and Licensing Board of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It has to do with the age-related degradation of the reactor pressure vessel, which holds the core of the nuclear reactor. And we've been trying for a decade to get a hearing on this issue, and we finally have gotten one. In fact, we have a discussion tomorrow with the licensing board about the schedule to come and the rules of the proceeding. So Entergy's lawyers will be on there, and the NRC staff, who is also opposing us, will be on there. And what this particular intervention is about is what's called the risk of ductile tearing of the reactor. If the pressure vessel gets too hot, the metal could just peel away and breach, and you'd have a loss of coolant accident and a reactor core meltdown. And if that meltdown went through the containment structures, then you would have a hazardous release of catastrophic proportions in terms of radioactivity. We have a second intervention that was denied a hearing, incredibly, on the risk of what's called brittle fracture due to pressurized thermal shock. And both of those proceedings, all of these risks, have to do with the neutron radiation bombardment of the metal of the reactor pressure vessel, both the plates in the walls and the welds that weld them together. So Palisades is 44 years old. It's one of the oldest operating reactors in the country. And the materials that were used to construct it contained a lot of impurities, especially copper. And these soft metal impurities, when subjected to this neutron radiation exposure, will weaken the vessel. And so if the emergency core cooling system is ever activated and cold water hits that hot metal, you could fracture it like a hot glass under cold water, except the hot glass is under 2,000 pounds of pressure per square inch, which adds to the forces involved. And I should hasten to add that this is an issue for all pressurized water reactors, and so there's a list of those most embrittled in the United States, and it includes Palisades at number one, worst, followed very closely by Point Beach Unit 2 in Wisconsin. Both Palisades and Point Beach Unit 2 are going to violate the NRC's screening criteria for embrittlement in 2017. It's actually much worse than that because they were predicted to violate it at Palisades as early as 1995, and they've simply played a lot of shenanigans with the calculations. And now they're saying it's 2017. With these new applications for license amendments, they want to take that out to 2031, which would be 60 years of operations at Palisades. And you've got some other infamous reactors on that short list of most embrittled. You've got Indian Point near New York City, unit number 3, and that violation date is 2025. And you've got Diablo Canyon, unit 1 in California, with a violation date of 2033. But like I said, they've played a lot of games with these dates. And so, you know, 2025 sounds like a long time into the future. Well, it could well be a problem right now, and it just takes a lot of digging to figure out what's going on.
Oh, my God. You know, there's no end to this, and these guys just completely cover it all up and want us to run away and not bother them while they run our planet into the ground. Palisades is on the west coast of Michigan. What's happening on the east coast with Fermi Unit 2 and 3?
Yeah, so Fermi Unit 1 melted down. It'll be 50 years ago in October of 2016. October 5th, 2016 will be the 50th anniversary of that meltdown. Fermi 2, as you mentioned, is an operating...
And of course, Fermi 1 was the subject of Gil Scott-Heron's great, and really one of the very first rap songs, We Almost Lost Detroit. And that was about the meltdown, the partial meltdown that occurred on October 6th. 1966, when I was a completely innocent senior editor at the University of Michigan Daily, a mere 40 miles away, and we were in the middle of the war. We were all working at the AP machine, all that stuff. We were totally informed about what was going on in the world, and I heard about this meltdown that almost killed us all 7 years later, actually 8 years later in 1974 when I read We Almost Lost Detroit. So now these geniuses that cost us $100 million with the meltdown of Fermi 1 went ahead and built Fermi 2, and they want to build Fermi 3.
Yeah, they've piled a lot of risk on that same site. So Fermi 2 is a General Electric boiling water reactor with a Mark 1 containment, which is identical in design to Fukushima Daiichi, only it's the biggest one that was ever built. It was a scaled-up version of Fukushima Daiichi. So units 1 and 2 in Japan put together are just about the same size as Fermi Unit 2. But risks at Fermi 2 also include a high-level radioactive waste storage pool that is much more loaded than any of the pools at Fukushima Daiichi, which came so close to mega catastrophe in Japan. So we have intervened
against... While we're on that, Kevin, there's something I wanted to bring up with you, and sorry to divert us away from Michigan here, but in my daily scan of the nuclear stuff on the Internet, I came into an article that claims that rather than the cores at Fukushima 1 and 2 continuing to exist, this article claimed that, in fact, Fukushima's first two cores completely vaporized. And actually, it wasn't a meltdown. They essentially had a slow burn, and that they're totally gone. And that all the radiation went into the atmosphere. Does that sound like a viable theory to you?
Well, it would have to be documented. One thing we do know, at least Tokyo Electric Power Company was willing to admit it, is that they tested Unit 1's reactor pressure vessel using a form of cosmic radiation called muons, and it's sort of an X-ray technique using the forces of nature as the source of the X-ray, I guess you could say. And they found that the Unit 1 reactor pressure vessel is completely empty. There's nothing in there. They're sticking by their, version that the meltdown simply melted through the bottom of the reactor pressure vessels and the molten cores then burned into the containment structures where they still reside. And Tokyo Electric claims that the containment's held, that the molten cores did not melt completely through the containment structures below, that they're being cooled there with something like 350 tons of cooling water every day being poured on top of units 1, 2, and 3. But where the cores are, we don't know.
That water then pours into the Pacific Ocean and is continuing to poison the Pacific Ocean with radiation.
Yeah, a fraction of that water does escape into the Pacific. They capture a large fraction of it, and then they hold it in these holding tanks, which are proliferating like mushrooms up the hillsides, waiting to be filtered. They're not done with that project after, going on 5 years now. So they've had a constant flow of radioactively contaminated groundwater into the ocean.
God. And so, but But this article held the theory that those cores are really not there anymore, that they were vaporized, that all that stuff went out into the atmosphere, and in fact, it wasn't a meltdown. They weren't melted down. They just, essentially slow fissioned and went out to the stacks.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions at Fukushima Daiichi. It'll be the fifth anniversary next March, so, you know, we have to wait and see or keep probing and keep pressuring Tokyo Electric and the Japanese government to, you know, let the information free, because they are in control of the information flow. You know, the cores, if you follow that logic of Tokyo Electric, the cores could well have melted completely through the containment structures and landed in the groundwater below. That's another possibility, that flow of radioactivity into the ocean is fed directly by molten core in the groundwater itself. But there's enough damage or just outright destruction to the containment structures that explains a lot of the radioactivity releases going on. And that's their official version, by the way.
Oh, God. All right, so tell us, jump us real quick from Fermi over to Davis Bessie as well.
Just real quickly on Fermi, we did intervene against the license extension at Fermi Unit 2, and the only contention we got in was the transmission line corridor is only about 300 yards wide, and it contains both Fermi 2's and the proposed Fermi 3's connection to the electric grid. So we raised a safety contention that entire connection to the electric grid, which runs the safety systems at the existing Fermi 2 and the proposed Fermi 3, could be taken out by a tornado or a terrorist attack or any number of scenarios, plunging both units at Fermi into a Fukushima-like situation where the only thing left would be the emergency diesel generators to run safety systems. And Fermi 2 has an infamous track record on emergency diesel generator failure. And Fermi 3, the NRC has granted a license to construct and operate Fermi 3, but there's not the money. So just you wait for Detroit Edison to look for nuclear loan guarantees at the federal level from taxpayers and ratepayer construction work in progress subsidies from the people of Michigan. That's going to be the next shoe to drop. But the nuclear waste confidence lawsuits take in both Fermi 2 and Fermi 3 and Davis Bessie. So if we prevail in that lawsuit, we could, you know, set back those licenses in a big way. Davis Bessie, the action right now is on this attempted ratepayer robbery at the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. We've, you know, made the record very clear that Davis Bessie's containment shell, its shield building, is severely cracked, and the cracking grows worse every time it freezes at that site. And also, Davis Bessie has a pressurized water reactor that's vulnerable enough to embrittlement of the reactor pressure vessel that the NRC has required First Energy to have an aging management plan, not just for its cracked shield building, or I should say cracking shield building, but also for the embrittlement of the reactor pressure vessel, just like at Palisades or Indian Point or Diablo Canyon. So we really got to block this $3 billion money grab at the PUCO to prop up this dangerous reactor, Davis Bessie.
Well, to make it clear, First Energy, which is based in Akron, has gone to the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio and asked for $3 billion to keep operating the Davis Bessie nuke, which is literally falling apart, and which cannot in any way, shape, or form compete with wind or solar, and simultaneously the Samus, S-A-M-M-I-S, coal-burning power plant, which is more than 50 years old. And, you know, I don't know how these guys can do this and maintain a straight face. But they have gone in, and they just changed presidents at First Energy. This guy, Anthony Alexander, who was really a piece of work, is on his way out. He's getting, like, you know, $100,000 an hour as a consultant from them. But, they are firmly committed to keeping coal and nuclear going well into the millennia to come, and they have made it very clear they want nothing to do with wind power. And Northern Ohio is a great wind power regime, The wind power, the wind is good there. It's steady. The land is flat. There's plenty of transmission. That's a big issue with a lot of wind is a lack of transmission. And the sources of the wind are actually very close to the cities of Toledo and Cleveland, where much of it will be consumed. And yet Davis Bessey continues to be the centerpiece of First Energy's Northern Ohio Energy Plan. And they are doing everything in their power to avoid going to wind power, including having the governor, John Kasich, currently a Koch brother candidate for president, put in a law that makes it virtually impossible to do wind power in northern Ohio. Absolutely insane. There was no public discussion. He slipped it into a budget bill, and they have essentially killed more than $2 billion of potential wind energy investment in northern Ohio. And at the same time, they're demanding huge bailouts for Davis Bessey. Now, Kevin, you're also involved in the bailout situation in Illinois. Can you tell us what Exelon is trying to do?
Yeah, Exelon is the largest nuclear utility in the country with about 24 reactors in its fleet. And it's gone to the Illinois legislature seeking a $1.5 billion bailout to prop up five reactors across Illinois that are losing money hand over fist. And so to prop up these uncompetitive, old, dirty, dangerous reactors, they want $1.5 billion from the people of Illinois. And at the very same time, they are trying to take over the utility in the D.C., Maryland, Northern Virginia neck of the woods called Pepco. And their intentions there are quite transparent. They would sabotage renewables and efficiency in the Mid-Atlantic, and they would funnel at least a portion of the ratepayer money that they're getting in the Mid-Atlantic back to Illinois to prop up those failing reactors. So this is, you know, connected in Illinois, at least, to the EPA's clean energy plan that's soon to be unveiled, I think next month. And that's Exelon's supposed justification for the bailout, is that they're such good guys on the climate that they need to be rewarded. And Dave Kraft of Nuclear Energy Information Service likes to go down the list of nuclear power's insurmountable risks, like the radioactive waste problem that can't be solved and the risk of Fukushima-like accidents, all this good stuff that nuclear brings to the table that Exelon would rather not be mentioned.
God, you know, the chutzpah of these guys, that's a nuclear physics term, by the way, chutzpah.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's really crazy is, like, that $3 billion in Ohio, they don't plan on using that to fix Davis Bessey's problems. They plan on sticking that in their pocket as pure profit, you know, executive salaries, like you mentioned, shareholder returns. So they would continue operating Davis Bessey with its huge risks, not address them, and just pocket that bailout. And I think it's fair to say the same in Illinois. It's all about the money. It's nothing about the safety.
God. Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, where can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, our website is just beyondnuclear.org, and you can find, you know, all the ways to contact us from email to phone on there.
Fantastic. Let's continue now. We don't have I don't have Skype with the studio now, so if someone can let me know if Rex Wire calls in, that'd be great. Kevin, what's happening?
Rex
with
is
Apple
there.
Canyon? What's that? Is Rex with us? Do we have Rex Wire? Not yet. Kevin, you're still with us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rex is there.
Harvey, if you can hear me, I'm here.
Oh, Rex, you're there. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Kevin Camps, meet Rex Wirer. Do you guys know
Hey,
each
Rex,
other?
How you doing?
Hi, Kevin.
Okay, so Kevin is a Greenpeace-level stalwart of the anti-nuclear movement. He's been a tremendous asset, and we just got through a scintillating conversation about nuke news. Are you, Kevin, where are you, Kevin? Are you in D.C.?
Yes, I am.
And Rex, you're in B.C., is that right?
I'm in British Columbia. I'm on the coast of British Columbia. Yes, West Coast.
All right. So listen, I can't resist, Kevin. I'm going to have you back. Of course, we'll talk about Diablo Canyon. Well, give us a very quick update on Diablo Canyon, if you would. The California reactors, West Rex is a West Coast kind of guy. And then we're going to segue in and talk about, and you're welcome to stay on, Kevin. We're going to talk about Joni Mitchell and the birth of Greenpeace. So tell us,
I'd love to stay on,
Kevin, before you go, about Diablo Canyon.
Yeah, well, the biggest risks of the day right now would be seismic risks. So you've got an NRC whistleblower who has revealed that Diablo Canyon is not built to withstand the earthquake potential of that site. You've got multiple earthquake fault lines in the vicinity, and NRC as an agency pretty much told them to shut up and go away and is complicit and collusive with Pacific Gas and Electric in covering up these earthquake risks. And so fortunately, Friends of the Earth and the grassroots movement in California are on this, are challenging it. There's going to be a hearing that Friends of the Earth has won from the NRC, and that's following the path that they took at San Onofre that caused the permanent shutdown of those two reactors in 2013. So let's hope that that same thing happens at Diablo Canyon. And I'll point out, I think I mentioned it, that Diablo, being a pressurized water reactor, is on that short list of embrittlement concerns at Diablo Canyon Unit 1. So Diablo is aging, and it was very dangerous when it was brand new. So needs to be shut down.
All right. Well, we're going to keep working on that. I'll have you back on to talk about it, and you stay with us. I'm just honored and thrilled to have Rex Weirer with us. Rex, I think you've been on my show before.
I have, Harvey. Yeah, last time I was on was maybe a year ago, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, well, you know, it all kind of fades into whatever. I'm writing a new history of the United States, and I just wrote a whole section about the 1960s, and, of course, I can't remember anything I wrote. So what happened, well, I saw an email from you, which, and then I remembered that a couple of weeks ago I saw an amazing movie called How to Change the World about the birth of Greenpeace. And I want to talk about that. But before we do, I have linked an article that you wrote about Joni Mitchell. And tell us the current situation of this great icon of our musical generation here. What's happening with Joni Mitchell?
Well, as far as I know, the last I've heard, some of your listeners may know that Joni had a brain aneurysm in March. See, is that right? No, May. It's in my article. Anyway, and she went into the hospital in L.A., at UCLA Medical Center. Very serious. A brain aneurysm can be very serious. In this case, it was. She's in serious condition, but she's back home, and she's... as far as I understand, she's making improvements every day, and she can make it. She's not well. She's in serious condition, but I understand she is making progress. So there you have it.
And you have a beautiful article about her. Where did you post? You have a website yourself. Where did you post it originally?
The article, if you just Google my name, Rex Weiler, W-E-Y-L-E-R, you'll find it. But it's. It's at my column called Deep Green, which is at the Greenpeace International website.
Okay, and you've known Joni Mitchell for many decades, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I heard her music as a young man. She's a bit older, and first heard her music at the Big Sur Folk Festival in 1969. I remember Stephen Stills introduced her, and saw her later at the Isle of Wight. With 600,000 other people. And then in 1971, Joni was the headliner at the concert that launched Greenpeace. It raised $17,000 to raise money to go on that first Greenpeace campaign to Amchitka. I stayed in contact with her several times over the years. She performed a couple of other benefits for the whale campaigns and for the whale movement and for the No Nukes movement and so forth. So she was, of course, an extraordinary musician who many of us from that era were fond of, and for her music alone. But she was also certainly an advocate for peace and ecology, and she did a lot for groups that needed that kind of support.
She's an amazing person. I never met her. I'd love to meet her, but you know, let's all get together and wish her well. Hope that she gets through this. You know, with a brain aneurysm, you're lucky to be alive. Let alone, you know.
They found her unconscious in her home, and but fortunately, she revived and she actually gained consciousness in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, and sounds like she's going to do okay. So we're all hoping for the best. But yeah, we're sending her our best wishes.
Okay, so I want to recommend this article. Just Google Joni Mitchell and Rex Weiler, R-E-X Weiler, and look at the article. I did post it at nukefree.org. And link it anyway at nukefree.org. And Rex, I really thank you for writing that piece. It's, I'm glad you've updated us on what she's doing. Now,
well, it was my pleasure. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I am, and like you, I think a voting member of Greenpeace, and
uh-huh.
I went to our recent voting member meeting in Oakland, and I'm thrilled to report that Greenpeace is not only alive and well, but doing really great. Over 300 people work for Greenpeace USA. The budget
yes.
seems solid. We have yeah. sane leadership, which has not always been the case. The wonderful Annie Leonard has followed the great Phil Radford and the fabulous John Passacantando. John was at the voting meeting. And
oh, was
members.
He?
Yeah, it was
yeah.
great. And Annie Leonard, I just have the tremendous admiration, respect, and love for Annie Leonard. I can't imagine a better person to be in charge of Greenpeace USA.
Oh,
right
I'm
now.
Really thrilled that Annie Leonard's taken on the leadership in the U.S. For Greenpeace in the U.S. And Greenpeace has had hard times in almost everywhere it's been, and it's had leadership challenges. But man, Annie Leonard is just doing a great job, and she's hardcore, Harvey, and that's the important thing. Is she's serious and she knows what the issues are, and she appears to be a great leader. I think people love her. So, yeah, it's really good news. And Greenpeace is actually looking for an international executive director right now. Kumi Naidu, who's been the international executive director now for, 6 or 7 years, maybe 8 years, is stepping down, and he's a wonderful person. I don't know if you've ever met Kumi, but he was an anti-apartheid activist in South Africa and very steeped in the civil rights and human rights issues in Africa, and became the head of Greenpeace and did just a fantastic job. And he's another person who's hardcore. He understands the issues, smart, and doesn't compromise. And that's, you know, I think from what you and I have seen over the years, Harvey, and many of our colleagues, after many, many decades of trying to just do common sense things to make this world reasonable, that, you know, sometimes maybe you have to compromise. But in general, we need to be even more stringent in our demands than we thought, because, you know, in all these issues, you know, progress is so bloody slow. It seems like it takes generations to do the simplest, most common sense thing, like protect ourselves from nuclear power or to protect wilderness and protect other species. It's just phenomenal how slow sometimes it can all go.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned I'm writing a new history of the U.S., and I just wrote a chapter about the 60s, which really was a headbanger. Boy, that took me a while. And I've just finished a chapter on Vietnam, and, geez, I mean, it's just mind-boggling what we have had to go through. But I have to say that Greenpeace is one of the great loves of my life. I got a call in 1990. The call that you dream of getting, I pick up the phone, there's a British accent, and it's the guy, Tom Hines. They said, would you like to come to Washington and run the nuclear campaign for Greenpeace? And I said, is that a trick question? But, you know, and the affiliation with Greenpeace is just wonderful. And Annie is such an amazing person. Anyone who doesn't know Annie Leonard listening to our show, go to The Story of Stuff. Annie did that, The Story of Stuff. And it's, you know, a present. Whoa, what do we got in the background?
Sorry, Harvey. That was.
Are you at a truck stop?
Yeah. I'm in a construction zone.
Getting to that. I saw this, and I was in D.C. with Annie, and right after the. San Francisco. Right after the voting members meeting. Actually, it was the night before, and we went to see this movie called How to Change the World. And anybody listening, you have got to see How to Change the World. It's one of the most moving films I've ever seen, especially as a Greenpeacer, but I think anybody would love it. And it has a tremendous portrayal of the birth of Greenpeace, focused on three immensely powerful, two immensely powerful and one, shall we say, questionable character. Paul Watson, who has gone on to found Sea Shepherd. And this is an amazingly focused, powerful, committed guy. And what a character. And the great Bob Hunter, who tragically is no longer with us. And how they interacted with Patrick Moore, who has now become the Benedict Arnold of the anti-nuclear movement. In the rise of Greenpeace, and you, of course, are very much a part of that. So tell us a bit about this troika and how Greenpeace really has evolved over the decades into, you know, it's still it's more powerful than ever, Greenpeace, actually, in a lot of ways, which is
Greenpeace
astounding.
Is doing very well. It's had all the challenges of growing and being big and international, and I'm sure you and your listeners can appreciate some of those challenges of growing up and being a big, huge organization and stretching across the world. But it's doing very well. But in the beginning, in the early days of Greenpeace, which was the early 1970s, Bob Hunter, first of all, I'll say about Bob Hunter, Harvey, is that, you know, you meet a few people in your life who, we meet a lot of people who are great people doing great work, and we love them and so forth. But you meet a few people, maybe one or two, who are just extraordinary, inspiring, brilliant, genius human beings. And Bob Hunter was certainly one of those.
Well, there's a word that describes people like that, which is transcendent. He was clearly a transcendent character.
And completely committed to transforming the world, and completely committed specifically at that time. I came to Vancouver because I was refusing to enter the Vietnam War era military, and I had been charged with 5 counts of breaking the Selective Service Act of the time, and was looking at going back to face charges in El Paso, Texas, and I just decided to blow that off and go to Canada. So I ended up in Canada. I ended up in Vancouver and met up with the peace activist community here, and there was a group called the Don't Make a Wave Committee at that time, which was a kind of an offshoot of the Sierra Club, and they had this idea of doing actions similar to the actions that the Quakers did, sailing boats into nuclear test zones. And that's the first thing we did in the early 70s, was do these anti-nuclear weapons protests. But in the back of our minds from day one was this idea of ecology. Now, it's very hard, especially for younger people, to looking back, and even for ourselves, to remember. In 1970, ecology was not a household word. Environment was not a household word. No one was getting ecology degrees at universities. It was an issue. People were starting to understand that there were some oil spills here and there, but ecology was not a massive issue like it is today. So what was in the back of our minds in those years was that we wanted to start an ecology movement that was on similar scale of the peace movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, and so forth. And we felt that this was the next thing that had to happen. We had to have an ecology movement, and we were a peace group, And as you recall, you may remember Harvey. Even today, people from our generation, when greeting each other or parting, would often say peace and give the peace sign. Well, one night at one of our meetings, Irving Stowe, one of the other founders, said peace, and Bill Darnell, another early Greenpeace founder, said make it a green peace, meaning, no, we have to add ecology onto the peace movement. And when everybody heard that term, make it a green peace, it was just instant. Everybody could hear it ring, and we knew that, yeah, that's it. And that's who we are, and that's who we've been for 45 years.
Well, that's how it was with No Nukes. You know, when we came up with No Nukes, that was, nobody even questioned it. It says, oh yeah, that's it, you know?
Uh huh. So, where was that? Tell me that story. Where did that happen?
Well, it came out of my typewriter initially, and then, we made bumper stickers, and it was just like part of the flow, you know. I was writing a page for the Greenfield Recorder in Western Massachusetts.
Yeah.
They gave me a page to explain why we were against the nuke that was coming into town.
Yeah.
And so I was writing up the page, and obviously we needed a slogan, and obviously it was going to be No Nukes. I mean, didn't even think twice. And somebody was obviously going to come up with it at some point. And then I designed I don't know if you saw you or Kevin have seen the original No Nukes bumper stickers, but there's a circle with two wavy lines in the middle on the very first ones that we printed up. And I thought that would become the universal symbol for renewable energy.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, as they say at Fenway Park, one out of two is not bad. So
yeah,
that one... That one never really took off, although I still like it. It's pretty, you know, but it did not become the universal symbol for renewable energy. But No Nukes was just a no-brainer, and we printed up the bumper stickers, and everybody loved it. So there you go, Greenpeace and No Nukes. So you guys went out, and you were on these boats, this film, How to Change the World, does a spectacular job of capturing the incredibly complex interpersonal relationships that were going on. I mean, it was like a great feature film of Oprah Winfrey, you know, a lot of it. It must have been so interesting you were on those boats. It must have been fascinating to follow this interpersonal stuff.
The making of that film was fun, just to be around it and relive all of that and go through it all and tell the stories and I met up with many of my old friends and colleagues in Vancouver on various trips down there to make this film. And it was great just thinking back and reliving it. And it was also, in a way, it was inspiring. You know, time goes on, life goes on. We move on and do other things, and we learn things, and we sometimes take our past for granted. But it was an extraordinary time, and... it's almost hard to imagine how we had such courage of our convictions, but nothing was going to stop us. I mean, we were all working other jobs to keep ourselves alive, but we were all just full-time activists. And
Rex? Here it is. You're talking about 1970. Here it is, 2015, a date that back then seemed like, you know, light years away.
Yeah.
And we're still doing this stuff. I mean, you have Kevin here on the line who does it full time. You and it's pretty much full time. I mean, what else do you do in your life besides fight for the environment, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And, Kevin, what era are you from? When were you born? What's your background?
Well, I was born in 69, and my big introduction to, you know, anti-nuke anything was the walk across America for Mother Earth, which was, you know, to shut down the Nevada test site. That was in 92.
Oh, yeah.
And then I landed back home in Michigan in 93, and one of the first things that happened to me was I heard Harvey speak in my hometown, and then I shifted over to the anti-nuclear power movement, and I've been doing that ever since.
Uh-huh. Excellent. And,
you know,
well, there you have it.
Any number of the people listening to the show, including some of the people working in our studio, the wonderful people at PRN, have, you know, still the deep commitments to saving the Earth that so many people still have. I mean, I have heard the anti-nuclear movement, the anti-war movement, the feminist movement, the Black civil rights movement, all written off by these, you know, pompous editorials year after year after year. They declare the end of the 60s, the end of the, you know, campaigns, this and that. As far as I can tell, for many millions of people, the 60s have never really ended.
It's,
you know,
never
we're
ended.
Still doing this stuff. No.
And,
why would
you know,
it
I
end?
Mean, I notice with my own children and their peers, they're pretty much like we were, Harvey. They care. They're active. No BS. And they're out to make changes and committed. And yeah, the, you know, that era got mocked a lot. The hippies, so-called, got mocked. The activists of that era got mocked in popular media. It almost became a... It sort of became a tradition to make a joke out of hippies and make a joke out of the 60s in that era. But, and that's one thing I love about this film, is that this film gets that era right. It gets that era correct. And, you know, we weren't just a bunch of crazies. We were thinking about what we were doing. People had skills, people had knowledge. And they knew how to apply that knowledge, and they simply chose to apply that knowledge to doing something other than just leveraging a better deal for themselves. And I have to give, you know, people credit when they recognize that, you know, they've been fortunate, they were born into a fortunate life and lifestyle, and they don't take that good fortune and just leverage it into more stuff and more fame and fortune for themselves, but they leverage it into helping out. And you know, in a way, that's what we did, and we're still doing it. And, you know, I've never gotten rich, but I've had a rich life. It couldn't be any richer. You know, I live in a beautiful place. And what more do you need, really? You know, we eat well. We have running water. You know, the birds are in the forest near my home, so I'm happy.
Well, I got to tell you something now. You know, when I wrote my first history of the U.S., I encountered a guy named Eugene V. Debs, who was the great socialist leader. And he was just an amazing human being, totally dedicated, completely selfless. I mean, they called him the American saint. And there was one quote that I will never forget that I came across, and I put it in the book. And he said basically that when I'm out working for the world, when I'm out working for the betterment of humankind, I'm really working for myself. Because I want to live in a world where people, where there's justice. You know, he was a labor leader, where everybody's well paid, where we don't have to worry about health care and education. And I want to be in a world where that's just and peaceful. And so, you know, here we are, you know, after all these years, and we're out there working, and people say, oh, you know, I admire what you do, and all that stuff. But we're really still just working for ourselves. I mean, we're working for air to feed and water to drink. And a decent environment for our kids and, you know, treats to look at. And, you know, it's certainly altruistic in some ways, but on the other hand, I think we're the ultimate realist. Because what good is our money if you can't breathe the water or drink the air? I mean, what's the point, you know?
Yeah, you can't spend it in the tomb, as Bob Dylan wrote, yeah, how rich can you be? And you can, you know, what can you get with all these riches at a certain point? You know, we live such wonderful lives that, I agree with you that in one sense it's altruistic. In the other sense, I'm not comfortable in a world where I see all that injustice and craziness and stupidity and do nothing about it. I'm not comfortable. So I do it for my own peace of mind and my own comfort that by working on the things I'm working on, I'm helping answer those questions. And I always said that activism, I'm neither a pessimist or an optimist. I see all the problems. I see that it's, in some cases, the solutions seem far away. But being an activist is what keeps me
okay. It makes me okay about it. At least I get up every day and there's something that I'm doing to make a change. And the problems don't go away. I'm not delusional about it, but it just gives me peace of mind.
Well, there's a great quote from one of our great activists, a historically significant guy named A.J. Musty, who was a tremendous advocate of nonviolence. And yeah. They asked him what it was like to be an activist. And he said, well, the pay's no good, but the work is steady. But pay is great. I mean, you know, the flip side of all this work that people do to save the environment, and Kevin, you're certainly a part of this, is that when you win, there's no money on earth. There's no amount of wealth, material wealth, that can match the sense of satisfaction when you make a significant difference at a significant point. I mean, what could you possibly do with money to match the feeling of shutting the San Onofre nuclear power plant? I mean, Kevin, you got any ideas on that?
Since we're having this U.S.-Canada exchange, I have to mention the Ontario Power Generation proposed radioactive waste dump on the Great Lakes shoreline. I mean, in a sense, we're in the fight of our lives, and we have to win it. So it'll be a great party when we do, and we're in the thick of that fight right now. So
wow. Yeah, great.
Oh, my God. We're out of time. We'll have to continue it. Great guest. Thank you so much. Kevin Camp, Rex Wire, we got to get back together, roll a joint, smoke it on the air, and talk more about the old war stories, okay? Thank you. Guys.
Great to hear from you, Harvey. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Harvey.
Kevin, great to meet you. Bye.
You too, Rex.
All right, guys.
Bye.
Take care. We'll see you next week.